I'm Rosalinda.
And are you part of the Compass Group?
Southwest Corridor Northwest Passage, the extended name of the project. So we're here by the Sanitarian Shipping Canal at a place called Noramco, which is a barge terminal, kind of a river port. And it has, this is what manages this place. There are all kinds of sub-leases and sub-letters. But it's mostly, so part of it, as you've seen, is for repair of the barges and the boats, and they're put on train tracks. I just really enjoy seeing the boats going on train tracks. It's almost like seeing a train going on the water. But anyway, and then the front part is where these big barges get towed in, and then they looks like they get parked for more long-term storage here. Looks like there's not as much quick transloading here as in other places. There's a big one being pushed right now. You see, it's a little tugboat pushing a big thing. They're covered so we can't see what's in them. It seems like in this part of the river, it's a lot of industrial materials. Not as much coal. Most of the coal stops farther south where we're going next. Not as much coal goes forward from here. A lot of gravel, industrial construction material, solvent, chemical solvents, salt, minerals of all kinds, and also metal. Big metal, sometimes machinery, sometimes scrap metal, or sometimes metal coils, like enormous metal coils. And about 2 miles up the canal from where this is a Sanitarian Ship Canal, about 2 miles up, the Sanitarian Ship Canal and the CalSag meet. So some of the things that don't park here go up to the CalSag. None of them continue on the Illinois Shipping Sanitarian Ship Canal to the Chicago River and downtown, right? That's why you don't see these when you go farther north. So this is before the CalSag forks off and goes towards the Calumet region.
And they might have had a different time period?
Yes, before the, 1910, 1920, much of the industrial shipping and the waterborne freight was going up the Sanitarian Ship Canal to the Chicago River and the mouth of the Chicago River, where the industrial port was at the time at Lake Michigan. The industrial port now, or the International Port District now, is at the mouth of the Calumet River and the Lake Michigan, not Chicago River. So when people talk about how nice it is that the Chicago River has cleaned up so well in the last 50, 60 years, that's because, it's not because there's some kind of remediation and eco-consciousness going on, it's because that's the financial center and all the shit has moved elsewhere. And translocated to the Calumet River and to various waterways in China, for example, right? So,
say a little about the history of the different linear water bodies, the Des Plaines River, which were the I&M Canal and the Sanitarian Ship Canal.
We haven't seen the I&M Canal yet today, but we will see it next where we go. There's a place where it's quite open and you can sort of see it. It's on the other side. So if we were able to cross, and which we can, I mean, there are like private roads, but we could just hop over and just run to it. And then the very next thing is the Sanitarian Ship Canal. And then another 25 feet, 30 feet away from that is the I&M Canal. It's just this little ditch right on the other side. First canal to be dug here in this area was the I&M, Illinois and Michigan Canal. And with the digging of that canal, the wetlands were, for all intents and purposes, drained. So it wasn't just that a canal opened up a waterway, but it also operated to separate land from water. So where before you had an extensive wetland where land and water are always in a dynamic relationship to each other, you have vast areas that are sometimes wet, sometimes dry, right? And entire flora, cultures and populations, and entire kind of micro bacterial and insect populations depend on that relationship. Cutting a canal created a permanent waterway that you could count on, that you could sort of know where it is at all times. It's not always overflowing its banks, it's not always moving, but also it produced dry land around it. It was a way to drain land. And when the congressional imperative to expand the United States westward, west of the Ohio River and into the Northwest Territories, even at the Greenville, Treaty of Greenville, the first dibs that the new nation had on land west of the Ohio River and west of Lake Michigan was not really on land. It was on a passageway. It was a bit of land at the mouth of the Chicago River and Lake Michigan, and then safe passage between that and the Mississippi, which meant on the waterways through the marshes. It didn't mean actually claiming land. And then later, building a canal through that was established again as a congressional imperative, and in order to fund it, the area would be mapped as parcels of land and sold off. But interestingly, when it was surveyed and mapped as land, there it wasn't land yet. It was like that, right? So the surveyors...
And you're pointing to the marsh.
To the marsh, right? But so that understanding that the canal would not only bring the possibility for speculative economic development, right? For grain, for strategic military kind of interconnections that would push back the British. That was still sort of the problem, is the competition with the British and stabilizing control of the territory. But it would also actually produce land as a commodity, you know.
What time period?
I think the sales began in the late 1820s, 1830s. The surveys, so the Treaty of Greenville that finally secures for the United States from the Three Fires Confederacy this kind of 10-mile tract of hypothetical land, of future land, is 1816. It's a long process, the Treaty of Greenville. There's the treaties beforehand that are then contested. There's a lot of warfare involved between the Americans and the indigenous peoples. And so Americans and still the English, right, who are still here and who still have forts and are still, like, not really relinquishing control. So, but 1816 is when the Three Fires are sort of forced and deceived into ceding this strip of land that later becomes the canal and canal lands. It's mapped in the 1820s, late 20s, and I think the first auctions begin shortly thereafter, either in 29 or 30, the first auctions for land in what is now northeastern Illinois.
On the north side, there is Indian Boundary Park.
Well, it establishes two Indian boundary lines. People think of one. It establishes a corridor defined by two Indian boundary lines. One, the northwestern one, was the one in Rogers Park. There was one south of that, right? So effectively what is claimed and ceded at that point is just a strip between two territories. It's not everything south of the Indian boundary line in Rogers Park that was claimed by the white settlers or by the white traders. It was just a 10-mile wide strip of land. So in the gallery we have some more accurate representations of, according to the first surveyor, Lewis Sullivan, the government surveyor. And so actually the practice of establishing Indian boundary lines is an English invention. So the French, the Dutch, the Spaniards, and the French each had very different and sometimes incompatible property regimes that they set up. They had different ways of claiming dominion. They had different ways of arming indigenous peoples and producing proxy wars through them. They had different ways of establishing control on the ground, or geographical possession. And the French did not establish boundary lines. The British did. That was kind of an invention. And it was a sort of the idea to produce something called Indian country that would be defined or bounded by these boundary lines, and that all parties would agree to not cross these lines. You'd find no Indians, but most importantly, supposedly, so the Americans borrowed the practice from the English of creating this thing called the boundary line, and then subsequently moving it. That's the other thing the British and English were doing, is there would be many boundary lines in many places. They were discontiguous and they would constantly move. And so if you look at how Indian country was produced, it's a moving and shrinking kind of area. So between the boundary lines is where you had absolute control and safe passage for only American traders. That means, right, an enclosure of a trade route. We are the only ones who can use this trade route. But on the other side of the Indian boundary lines, supposedly you would find only Indians, right? That it would be not legal to cross, and it would be not legal for squatters, right? Which were frontier settlers that were often quite rogue in relation to federal policy, although often they were protected by federal troops. So they had a bit of a weird extraterritorial activity. Squatters were supposedly not allowed to settle on the other side of Indian boundary lines, although there are plenty of accounts of sort of congressional support for that and for, you know, sort of frontier squatters who were seen as rogue actually being used as a, you know, sort of colonial force or colonizing force.
Official.
Well, yeah, official. Yeah, I mean, it was official because they were always protected by federal troops.
Right.
They were absolutely, it's like
Israel,
Palestine,
yeah.
Right? The settlements, which are supposedly these rogue things, that the government occasionally might go and like put a restraint on one or the other. As a matter of fact, they have the full protection. It's predicated on the force and the might of the Israeli military. But it's not, if it's just a handful of rogue settlers trying to establish these things, it would never work.